The United States. In a very sudden way, he carried the United States through one of the scariest chapters in its history. And yet, he had to be carried wherever he went. He taught Americans that they stood for better than any other political figure of his time, and yet he himself could not stand. He had the power to raise a nation from its knees, but yet he could not even bend his own. It's not surprising that of all the many great things that he did and said, what he's remembered best for is his words about fear. FDR knew fear. He knew it personally and intimately, but he was not a prisoner of it, nor did he try to imprison others with it. He seemed always, rather, to be motivated by a power greater than fear and inspired Americans to believe that despite fearful times, we too could operate from higher principles if we only knew where to turn. I lift up mine eyes to the hills, says Psalm 121. From whence shall my strength come? From whence shall my strength come? It's a good question for us to consider today. The last few sermons that I've done here have been about fear, talking about spiders and webs and churches and other things that a lot of people are afraid of. And last week in a letter to the next president, talking about how leadership these days is so often tinged with fear, trying to scare people into doing what we want them to do. But today I want to explore some of the alternatives, to explore what it's like to lead from a consciousness beyond fear. Living beyond a consciousness of fear is often what most of us would like to do in our own lives, even when we aren't always sure how. From whence shall my strength come? I think it's a great question for us here at Brew as we stand on the precipice of so much great change. The distinguishing question before us seems to be whether we will grow to be as big as the times that we're in, whether we will rise to some of the challenges around us that are felt by Prince William County and indeed the whole country, and whether we'll be able to see that it's not what's around us or before us that compels us toward the love that we want, but it's what's within us. Our biggest challenge could well be to climb out of those fearful habits and reimagine new, energizing, and empowering ways of doing things. You've heard it before. If you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always gotten. And it's certainly true when it comes to operating out of fear. To make a change, we've got to do what FDR prompted the nation to do. And that is to turn around and address what is frightening us. In his words, address the fear that, quote, paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. I would like to examine some of what I believe might have helped FDR overcome his own fear and the strength that he summoned to help a nation overcome theirs. And to help us do that, I want to put before you a simple scenario for you to consider while I blather on with the rest of the sermon. So just consider this particular part. Imagine someone, a stranger, someone you don't know, you've never met, imagine that they arrive at the congregation. And all it takes is one look from across the room for you to notice that this person, this man, is afraid. You notice the uncertainty. You sense he is even hesitant to walk through the door, shy to speak, resists eye contact, avoids interactions. He walks around and reads all the announcements, trying to find something that will help him feel like he's safe, like he belongs here. And there is something else that you notice about him. He's carrying something, and he carries it close to him as though he feels like it's protecting him, feels like it's helping him to feel safe and helping him to feel powerful. And imagine that you see him, and it's early on a Sunday morning, and you are some of the only people in the building. Imagine, what do you feel? When you see him, what do you do? And most importantly, from whence shall your strength come? Now ponder that as I turn to the question of strength and where to find it. And let me begin by sharing a very interesting perspective from medical doctor, psychologist, and author David Hawkins. Hawkins, about 12 years ago, developed a hypothesis around the idea that strength grows in the vicinity of truth. The more powerful truth that we're in the midst of, the more powerful strength we seem to summon. Does that make sense? Right? Truth, in other words, is an anabolic influence or energy-giving influence. Falsehood, or the absence of truth, becomes a catabolic or energy-draining influence. Does that make sense? Now, he looked for a way to test this hypothesis, and he came upon a practice that's used in alternative medicine called applied kinesiology. Anybody heard of it? Few people? Applied kinesiology tests subjects by asking them to extend their arm straight out and to focus on a series of spoken statements. Now, while statements are addressed to the subject, pressure is applied downward on their wrist, and researchers reported that false statements spoken resulted in a test subject's muscles weakening so that they would lower their arm. And yet true statements resulted in the subject maintaining their strength, ability to resist the pressure. Does that make sense? So advocates of this technique claim that it is reliable even when the subjects are not themselves consciously aware of whether the statements they are being told are true or not, right? So a doctor, for example, could do this test on somebody and say the statement, your kidneys are having trouble processing something you ate. And depending on whether their arm went down or stayed up, you would know if that was true or not. Now, most practitioners of applied kinesiology use it for allergy testing or nutritional deficiencies. But Hawkins was interested in using this method to calibrate energy levels associated with levels of consciousness. In other words, using a subject's calibrated muscle response to correlate to the level of truth or the level of consciousness that they were operating from, right? So this is an interesting idea that says that our motives, our assumptions, our attitudes can be correlated to the energy that we have to use to work with, right? From whence shall our strength come? Now, let me say, as a pharmaceutical engineer for 10 years before I entered the ministry, and somebody who has a great appreciation for the scientific method, I will tell you that I have some trouble with the methodology that Hawkins employs. And I don't agree with some of his assertions. But there are very important aspects of his findings that I have no trouble with, and indeed feel would be foolish to dismiss out of hand. And one of them is this chart. If you look, you'll notice from bottom to top, there are increasing levels of consciousness corresponding to calibrated energy levels. And there's, in this middle column, the emotions that are associated with those levels of consciousness, right? So notice that there is very little energy operating from shame. In shame, one hangs their head, drops their shoulders, slinks away. There is low self-esteem. Guilt is only slightly higher, furnishing the energy of judgment and self-recrimination. There's also the energy to project remorse on others. Guilt has often been misused by religion to coerce or control the people with a preoccupation of sin. In the level of apathy, some of the negative, debilitating energy is removed, but no positive energy is yet summoned and employed. People in a consciousness of apathy often lead precarious lives because they can't even summon enough self-care to meet even the basic needs. Those in grief struggle to find energy because they see loss everywhere around them and they fail to notice hope. Regret and depression reign, and failure is viewed as inevitable. Grief has more energy, however, than apathy, because when caregivers see a traumatized, apathetic patient begin to cry, it is usually a sign that they are getting better. At the level of 100, there is much more energy available for life. Fear runs much of the world. Fear of enemies, fear of losing possessions, fear of losing status or beauty or youth, fear of losing your church. These can all be very energetic motivators. But fear can also be paralyzing and requires tremendous energy intervening to rise above. Oppressed people or people in abusive relationships often struggle to reach higher levels of consciousness without help. Thus, the fearful seek strong leaders, rescuers, to help them out of what imprisons them. More energy is found when you get to desire. Desire motivates. It runs the economy. It is the heart and soul of Madison Avenue. But it is mostly an inward energy, often working at the level of addictions. People caught in a consciousness of desire feed on other things, feed even on other people to fill the hole they feel inside. Anger really begins to summon energy. And although associated with destruction, anger can be remarkably constructive. It can be the fulcrum by which depressed people eventually become catapulted to freedom, yet too often it is not harnessed into a constructive plan. And when dispersed unconsciously, it has corrosive effects on one's relationships. The level of pride has enough energy to run the United States Marine Corps. It provides those who reach it some level of self-esteem. The downside of pride, as with all the levels below pride, is that it's by its nature competitive. It often requires energy to operate, requires energy in the form of attention from others. But a radical shift comes when we get to the next level. The level of courage implies new examination, new possibility. Suddenly you have enough energy to go beyond the fear that you feel. Anxiety, although present, no longer cripples an endeavor when courage is present. At the level of neutrality, people escape the world of dichotomies. Rigid stances and needing things to be black and white fall away. Complexity is entertained, and people at this level experience less attachment to being right or getting their way. At the level of willingness, people stop putting energy into self-protection and start putting it into interaction and group participation. Pride no longer dominates them, and they are willing to look at their own defects and learn from others how to do things better. People who operate from a consciousness of acceptance find something that had been elusive at lower levels. They find freedom. They begin to feel free to get in touch with an internal sense of satisfaction rather than seeking what they need from outside of themselves, so that love and purpose and meaning are found from within. Acceptance seeks to include rather than reject. A consciousness of reason enables one to handle large, complex ideas and make rapid correlations. Knowledge and education become highly prized, and understanding becomes a primary motivator. But ironically, getting beyond reason sometimes proves difficult. Although reason is highly useful, it can itself be paradoxically an attachment. to getting beyond into areas of love, rather where love operates as the primary criteria rather than logic. Above the level of 500, you get into the consciousness of love. And what we think of in the world of love is usually not. Mostly what we see described by society as love is actually an intense emotionality combining physical attraction and possessiveness, control, a sense of security, eroticism, and personal pleasure. The mere fact that this kind of love can so easily turn into hate is an indication that we are probably talking more about desire or pride. A consciousness of love is actually a statement of relationality. It is interdependent. It is forgiving. It is unconditional. Love dissolves negativity by recontextualizing it rather than attacking it. This is really the level of true happiness. Even rarer is the level of joy. In this state of consciousness, everything happens effortlessly and seems clearly synchronized with all other things around it. Near-death experiences are said to be glimpses into this level of consciousness, and such glimpses, even though very short, are powerful enough to alter those who experience them for the rest of their lives. The energy field associated with peace is described by such terms like transcendence and actualization and God consciousness. I once had an experience where I was in an outdoor amphitheater and the Dalai Lama walked within 10 feet of me and I could feel his presence literally move through me. It is extremely rare to be in the presence of that kind of consciousness. And they say, and Hawkins in his book says, that it's attained by about 1 in 10 million. At the level of enlightenment, there is no longer an experience of individual self separate from others. There is no longer any identification of the physical body as self and it accompanies a non-dualistic way of thinking or a sense of oneness. All of these levels of consciousness are discussed in Hawkins' book, Power Versus Force. Now, one of the most powerful ideas that Hawkins promotes is the distinction between power and force, based on those levels of consciousness. The critical difference is that one comes from a higher consciousness, power, and one comes from a lower consciousness, force. The 200 level, where courage, pride and courage are separated, is the critical divide. And at levels below 200, the primary focus is on individual survival, where energy becomes available, usually through desire or fear or anger and pride. It is often characterized by self-serving impulses of personal gain. At this level, energy is channeled into force, where we try and coerce or manipulate others around us in order to ease our own pain and meet our own personal needs. But at the level above courage, the focus shifts towards others' well-being. We seek to use our energy generously and contributively to influence and inspire, motivate, or ennoble those around us. Now, you might understand this really much better just intuitively or experientially. So imagine, think back. Have you ever been in a conversation with somebody who, even after a really deep, complex conversation for maybe an hour, you walked away just feeling energized and inspired and excited and ready to do some great things? And then have you ever been in the company of someone who, even after just 10 minutes, just seemed to suck the very life right out of you so that you had to go off and make another appointment with your therapist? If you've had these two different experiences, you'll know that there's a difference between power and force. And it makes the question even more relevant. From whence shall our strength come? If we were to employ this test of applied kinesiology and hold our collective arms out to truth, where would we come down? As people? as a community, as a congregation? Would it show that we come to serve ourselves, to use others for our gain? Or do we come and use our energy generously for others' benefit? From whence does our strength come? Well, we can't do that test, but we can do another. Remember, I asked you early on to imagine someone new that you hadn't met walking into church, someone who appeared afraid, someone carrying something. How would you respond to them? If you were coming from a level of shame, he might appear dirty or inappropriate, unworthy. From eyes fixed with guilt, you would blame him for his condition. He's probably a welfare cheat, deserving of his fate. From apathy, it is clear that nothing can be done and we should just forget about him. From grief, he looks tragic and we turn away to avoid seeing a happy ending. From a level of fear, we might find him threatening and call the police. The perspective of desire wonders why society hasn't done something already. From a place of anger, we would be furious that these kinds of problems exist, especially in our neighborhood. Someone possessing pride would find this a little embarrassing. We can't have him in our church. But at a level of courage, we begin to explore what can be done, what's needed, a shelter, a job, a place to live. At neutrality, he ceases to look so offensive. In a stage of willingness, we might even go up and talk to him and begin exploring ways that might help. With acceptance, we become curious as to his story, looking to understand. And with reason, we see him as a symptom of a larger problem worthy of our attention. With love, we see him with compassion. And we see our role to extend ourselves to suffer with him. Compassion means to suffer with. From a level of joy, we begin to see the wisdom that he might be offering us. And in peace, he is a temporary expression of ourselves. Now here's the test. I mentioned before when you saw him that he was holding on to something. He was protecting something. Imagine that it was his own inherent worth and dignity. Did you feel the impulse to take it from him in order for you to feel safer? Or did you look for ways to affirm it for him and help it grow so that he could find his own place? The difference in how we see him, the difference in how we respond to him, will tell us a little bit about the influence of power and force in our lives and in our communities. From whence does our strength come? Hawkins believes that 85% of the world operates from below the critical level of courage. Much of the world, therefore, operates out of manipulation and coercion and force. But he also believes that because these levels are measured on a logarithmic scale, the influence of a few loving people can raise the collective consciousness of entire communities exponentially. And the collective consciousness of a powerful, loving community can counterbalance entire populations gripped in fear. I believe that was one of the reasons why FDR had such an amazing impact on an entire nation. And I believe that we are called to be such a powerful, loving community. Brew possesses a consciousness that is courageous, that is bold. We experience a willingness to take on new challenges. We offer acceptance of one another. We build a planet transformed by our care. Anybody who saw Brad Harshman last night knows that this community possesses incredible courage. And anybody who saw the response of this congregation to Brad Harshman last night knows that we possess a consciousness of love. We look beyond black and white. we employ reason. And most of all, we have the capacity to care deeply, to affirm the worth and dignity of people who come to us in need. But we must forever be aware that we are always being tested by the truth, always asked to summon love, summon the power to inspire rather than the force to manipulate. In short, we must always ask ourselves, from whence shall our strength come? I believe that we are called to emulate Roosevelt's challenge and his courage to us as he closed his inaugural address with these words. These dark days will be worth all they cost us if they teach us that our true destiny is not to be ministered unto, but to minister to ourselves and to the fellowship of all life. We now realize, as we have never realized before, our interdependence upon one another, that we cannot merely take, but we must give as well. That if we are to go forward, we must move as a trained and loyal gathering, willing to sacrifice for the good of a common discipline, because without such discipline, no progress is made and no leadership can ever be possible. It is not a question of whether or not we live in fearsome times. It is only a question of whether we shall draw our strength from fear or something a little higher, to the glory of life.